Welcome to the Wheel With It podcast with your host, Devin. At Wheel With It, we are dedicated to exploring DEI issues in a fair, balanced, and fun way. Let's get into the episode.
Hey guys, just a heads up that this episode has audio that is a little spotty in places. We normally try to avoid that, but this episode has audio that's a little spotty in places. So just a heads up. Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Wheel With It. Today, we have Martin Lockett on the podcast with us today. And I am your host, Devin Wieters. How are you, Martin?
I am doing awesome, Devin. How are you doing this morning?
Good. So first of all, tell us about yourself, and then we'll go from there.
So my name is Martin Lockett, and I am a mental health and substance abuse counselor. I've been doing it for a couple years, and you'll hear about why I got into this, but I spent 17 and a half years in prison as a result of my addiction, and I decided to then make my life's work about this mission of helping people who struggle with substance use issues in a way to honor my victims. And so I'm very happy with the work that I do today, and I speak around the country, and I'm just happy to be able to share some of my story today.
I know it's a tough story, but how did you get into this?
Just a brief synopsis of where things started for me. I grew up in Portland, Oregon in the 80s. And Portland is much different today than it was in the 80s. People know Portland for the naked bike rides and just for a very liberal state. And back then, it was quite different. It was a war zone. There were gangs fighting for, you know, drug territory. It was the height of the crack epidemic. There were drive-by shootings every other night. It was pretty bad. And thankfully, I have a twin brother and two older sisters, and we were raised by two very loving, nurturing parents who did everything they could to keep us from these negative influences. And that worked well until I got to high school. I was a very shy kid. And so I would basically do anything to hang out with anybody who would accept me. So this led to me hanging out with some not so good kids. And in that, I started to drink because it was a way for me to loosen up socially and be able to talk to people without getting nervous and fumbling over my words and things like that. And that was my infatuation with alcohol initially at age 14. And then things changed around age 16 when I started to drink for different reasons, because now I'm starting to think about my life beyond high school and what I would do with myself and what type of career I would have and who I would be. And there was a lot of insecurity around that. And growing up where I grew up, there were not a lot of positive examples around me for people who made it out of poverty and were successful. So I put a ceiling on my life, and I really didn't think that I would be capable of doing much. And so this was very depressing for me. And I remember I started to drink to just numb those feelings and not have to think about that. And so that was when I became addicted to alcohol, where I would drink before I went to school, during my lunch breaks, after school, I just drank and drank some more. And this led to why I am here today, because something very tragic happened on New Year's Eve of 2003, when I was 24 years of age.
Do you mind delving into what happened?
I would absolutely like to talk about that. So at the time, just paint the scene. So I'm drinking every day, right? But I'm also working at a warehouse full time. I wouldn't show up to work drunk or anything like that. I was great at my job. They loved me. I'm also taking community college courses at the time with aspirations of becoming a nurse. And so I'm doing my classes. I'm getting good grades and things like that. I'm paying my bills. I was living with my girlfriend in Vancouver, Washington. So I moved out of my parents' house. On the surface, it looked like I had my life together. But this allowed me to drink every single day and not think twice about it, because I'm thinking, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not underneath a bridge with the beer bottle passed out. That's an alcoholic. That's what I would tell myself. And New Year's Eve of 2003, day started off like any normal day. I traveled from my home in Vancouver, Washington, to a warehouse in Portland where I worked at the time. And I remember we had gotten off work early because of the holiday. And we're wrapping things up at about 11 o'clock. And as we're about to leave, my boss had joked with us. He said, "Now you guys go out and have a good time tonight, celebrate the new year, but do not let me wake up and see you on the front page of the newspaper." And of course, we all laughed it off. Nobody thinks twice about it. We clocked out. But as you can see, almost 20 years later, I've never forgotten that statement. So I leave work. I go straight to the liquor store. I bought a fifth of gin. I then went to my parents' house to hang out with my twin brother. And I drank the alcohol by myself. And then he and I had made plans to attend a friend's house party that night, a guy we had gone to high school with. And so after I drank that entire fifth of gin, I then went back to the store where I bought 4 24-ounce cans of beer. And the quick mathematicians out there will know that is 96 ounces of beer that I drank between the hours of about 5 and 8 o'clock that night. And so then my brother and I decided we would go to another friend's house in the meantime to hang out because we didn't want to get to the party too early. So we get to that friend's house. The three of us hang out. We drink a pint of Hennessy between us. It's now about 11 o'clock and we go to exit his apartment. And here's warning number two. His mother yells out from the kitchen. Now, y'all be careful tonight. You hear? And of course, we reply, yes, ma'am. We'll be careful. We're good. Obviously, we had no intentions of being careful that night. So we get to the party. We see a bunch of old classmates. We drink more alcohol, of course. We celebrate, bring in the new year. Everything is great. We exit the party at about 12:15 a.m. Three of us get into my vehicle. I drop my friend off, no problem. Get back onto the freeway to take my brother home. And at this point, all I'm thinking about is how exhausted I am. And I can't wait to get him home because I knew I still had another half hour or so to drive to my house in Vancouver, Washington. So on the freeway, I began to pick up my speed to about 80 miles an hour. And my brother says, hey, man, you should slow down. The police are out, but being a holiday and all. And I thought for a second, that makes sense, right? He's right about that. So let me go ahead and slow down. So I did that. And then we exit the freeway. And now we're driving in a residential area. And again, I began to pick up my speed now to about 60 miles an hour, 30 zone. And my brother, this time, he gets angry with me. And he begins to yell, slow down before we crash. And I snap back at him, calm down. I know what I'm doing. I've got this. I've done it 100 times. But just to appease him, keep him quiet, I went ahead and slowed down. We drive for about 10 more minutes. And I'm just about to get into the left-hand turning lane to drop him off at our parents' house when he suddenly realizes he's all out of cigarettes. So he says, hey, man, let's go up the road so I can get some cigarettes. I'm all out. And in my mind, I'm thinking, great. You know, here's one more stop that I don't want to have to make. I just want to go home and go to sleep. So we drive for a couple blocks. And then about 2 blocks from that point, there's an intersection. And the store we need to get to is just beyond the intersection. And so I'm looking up at the light, and the light is yellow. And as intoxicated as I was, I still knew there was no way I was going to make this light. There was just no way. But it didn't matter because I just want to get these stupid cigarettes and go home. So I immediately made the decision to go right through. And I punched the gas, and I remember I become tunnel vision, where I don't see anything to the right or left of me. And literally within seconds, boom, it's just this earth-shattering crash. And then I remember the airbag deploys and is enveloped my face, and it feels like I'm being suffocated by a parachute. And my car comes to a slow winding halt. And my first instinct was to check to see if my brother's okay. And he started moving a little bit. So I'm relieved they were both alive. And a guy comes rushing up to the driver's side door. He was on foot. He says, are you guys okay? Are you guys okay? Yeah, we're okay, I tell him. And I step out of my vehicle. And sadly, my first instinct was not to go check on the people I had just hit, but rather to assess the damage on my own car, because my car was everything to me. It was my status symbol of success, right? It was what conveyed importance on me. And so I'm walking around my vehicle and I'm looking at my custom rims that are totally destroyed. The entire front end is smashed inward. And I'm devastated because I'm now looking at my prized possession in a heap of crumpled metal. And then my brother gets my attention. And he starts to point across the street where the car had spun about 60 or 70 feet before it stopped. And he said, hey, man, he said, I think I see somebody lying down on the pavement over there and it doesn't look like they're moving. So in that moment, it starts to resonate and dawn on me the magnitude and severity of what I just done. This is really serious. No, they could be dead. And there's no time to process anything, of course, because within seconds, lights and sirens are everywhere rushing to the scene. And so the policemen are there and they're talking to me. And I remember they take my brother a few feet away to talk to him. And about 3 minutes into that interview, that officer confirmed to me what I had already known in my heart of hearts to be true, which was that person who was lying on the pavement had perished. And he told me that another person was being driven to the trauma center just blocks away by ambulance, of course. And so I'm placed under arrest and I'm put into the back of the police car and we head for downtown for processing. And from the back seat, I'm listening to the police radio because there's a lot of chatter about the crash, as you can imagine. And so about 10 minutes into that ride downtown, I could hear it come over the police radio that unbeknownst to me, there was another passenger who had been pronounced dead at the scene. So there was one survivor. And as we drive past my parents' block, I'm in the back of the cruiser, and we drive past my parents' block, I take a look down the street one last time, because I know that based on the sentencing laws in the state of Oregon, that I'm going to go to prison for about 20 years. I know that, no matter what. And so when I look down their street one last time and I look at the house, I know that I'm not going to see that block for about the next 20 years.
Dang. How did that feel, first of all?
It was obviously the worst day in a lot of people's lives. But the fact is, I'm still alive, right? And I know even in that moment, as intoxicated as I was and this horrific event that just happened, I'm grateful to still be alive. But I'm also very much looking at my 24-year-old life. I look at it like it's over, right? I'm going to go to prison until I'm 40-something years old, and I can't even think about who Martin is going to be at 40-something years old. I can't even fathom that, right, at 24 years of age. 40 is somebody just old, and, like, they're just, like, you think all these things.
Yeah, like, I remember we were at a family gathering one time, and it was a surprise for my grandmother, so, like, for her 80th birthday, so all the family came up, and I'm a little socially anxious, so I was anxious about this anyway, and we were driving to get lunch that day. We were going to dinner, but we were driving to get lunch just for my parents and I, because I still live with my parents. And I was like, I can't even visualize being 40. And then he went, my dad, who was like 50-something at the time, went, neither can I. And we were all joking about that at the table that night. But at 20-something, you can't even imagine 40. I can now, because I realize I'm going to be 40 sooner than later, and it's not that old, but it was just a joke. But
no, you're right. And so I see my whole life flash before my eyes, and I know that this is it, right? I'm going to go to prison, and this is it. I get booked into the county jail. I'm charged with 2 counts of manslaughter in the first degree. I'm charged with an assault because of the guy who got injured in the crash, and thankfully he survived. But in the moment, I didn't know if he was going to survive. He could have died as well, right? That would have been 3 manslaughter charges. And in Oregon, each one carries a mandatory minimum of 10 years in prison day for day, right? You can't earn any time off or good behavior or working a job or getting an education, staying out of trouble. It doesn't matter. You have to do 10 years a day for each manslaughter in the first degree. And I've got 2 of them. So I know that I'm going to go to prison for a really long time. 3 days after this happened, I'm in my cell. I'm just minding my own business. And I noticed someone had slid the Oregonian newspaper underneath my door. And I thought, I don't know why somebody's giving me a newspaper. I didn't ask anybody to see a paper. I figured there must be something important in there for me to read. So I pick it up. I begin to thumb through this paper and I see my picture on the front page of one of the sections. And I read these paragraphs. And for the first time in days, my faceless victims became people. And these people had an incredible story. And their story was they were recovering addicts who had managed to turn their lives around. They had 16, 17 years clean and sober, right? They were.
This blew my mind when I heard it on Label 3. I was like,
yes.
That is the irony of all ironies. Go ahead.
It was a palpable irony. What the columnist called it, a palpable irony, that these people who had devoted their lives to helping people get clean and sober would have their lives cut short by a drunk driver. And then he said something at the end of the article that totally changed my life forever, right? He said, perhaps the person they will have ended up helping the most is the man who's charged with killing them. And at the time, again, I'm only 24 years old, and I know I'm going to go to prison for almost 20 years. So there's no way I could fathom how this situation was possibly going to help me, but I knew what he said was profound. And so I had to figure out what that statement was supposed to mean for my life. And so I remember I started to meditate on it. I would pray about it. I would ask God to reveal to me how these words were supposed to apply to my life, because I had no idea. I just knew I was going to go to prison for a really long time. And then months later, it finally came to me that the only way this tragedy will not be in vain is if I carry on these people's legacies, if I literally do everything I can to help people who are struggling in active addiction so that they don't have to continue to cause harm to themselves, to their families, to their communities, to society, right? Because that's what these amazing people were doing the night that I had taken from this earth. They were coming home from a clean and sober New Year's Eve party that night, going home to get some sleep. And here I come speeding up the road, running through a red light, crashing into them and killing two of them. And so in that moment, that's exactly what I vowed to do. I said, I'm going to commit myself to this work for the rest of my life. I don't know how it's going to look. I don't know exactly what I'm going to be doing, but I know that I'm committed to this purpose. And so that was how everything started for me.
Which is like amazing. And quick side story. I've only been drunk one time. It was at a 21st birthday party. We laugh about it now because I was safe. My parents drove me home. We laugh about it now. But I didn't even do the bar hopping after the restaurant hop that we did, because we went to, have you been to Virginia Beach before?
I have not.
Okay. There's this place called Counselor, and there's restaurants there. So we had dinner at the Cheesecake Factory. You've been to the Cheesecake Factory.
I have.
It takes 2 hours.
It does.
So the way this particular store had their buzzer set up, it worked if you went to any of the other restaurants, like to encourage people to go to the other places and get a drink while we wait. So we did a kind of hop around there. And then, of course, it was the 21st birthday, so we went back to the Cheesecake Factory for dinner and drank some more. And like I said, we laugh about it now because it's hilarious. But I didn't even do the bar hopping afterwards because my parents had to drive me and drop me off. And my mom gets up at 4 in the morning to work because she's at her desk. But I was like, please, can I go bar hopping? Because I never get to go out. And she's not that I get up at 4:30 in the morning. But even with those drinks that I had, and I didn't even do the bar hopping, I was really drunk looking back on it. So alcohol can hit you so fast.
Yes.
You don't realize how fast it can hit. It's crazy.
Right. And the first thing that goes is your judgment, right? Your ability to think clearly, think rationally, make good decisions. And then shortly thereafter, it's your motor skills, right? And your reactivity time and things like that. It's operating a motor vehicle is the absolute worst, one of the worst places you can find yourself in after you've been drinking, right? Which is why we have laws in all 50 states around the amount of alcohol that can be in your system, a very low concentration before you reach a threshold where it's illegal, because it becomes dangerous for everybody on the road. And so with that, so I commit to this cause. A few months later, I take a plea bargain to avoid going to trial. So I take a plea bargain for 17 and a half years. And again, that's day for day. I didn't get out a single day early. I did 17 and a half years, 210 months from January 1st of 2004 until June 28th of 2021 is when I was released. But there was a lot that happened during that time, right? So I'm committed to this cause. I figure if I'm going to help people who are struggling in addiction, then I should probably get a degree, because I want to become a counselor, right? That's the easiest way to do this work. At the time, I had a GED, and they were offering, you could take one community college course per term at the prison, and we would pay like $25 for this course, for each course. And they would have professors come down from the community college into the prison, and we would do, like 12 of us would do a class. So I signed up for that, and I'm taking one class per term, and I do that for 3 years, and then I lose my father. My father passes away, but in that happening, it was very unexpected, but in that happening, we were able to get his pension and his life insurance policies, things like that. So now I can afford to take classes from universities outside of the prison, right? So I started to take those classes. We don't have any internet, so everything is done through the snail mail system, paper, right? So I do that, and then I get an associate's degree from Indiana University in 2010, and then I went on to get a bachelor's degree in sociology from Colorado State in 2013, and then I went on to get a master's in psychology from California Coast University in 2016.
So how long did it take you to do all that? If you were only about, like, I'm very passionate about criminal justice reform. After we get off here, I'll tell you more about that. But I knew you could educate yourself in prison, but I didn't know it was that stringent that you only had to take one class at a time. Like, how do they expect you to get anything done?
So a lot of people, there's a misconception. So the federal Pell Grants went away in the 90s when Bill Clinton was in office, and it was this whole tough on crime approach. And so when he signed the crime bill, as they call it, it took away any funding for anybody in state or federal prison to get any federal money for education. So the only thing that's available is a GED. Beyond that, you have to pay for it yourself in most cases. And so the reason why we were able to take one community college course at a time is because there were these little old ladies who were retired teachers had set up this foundation to get money donated so that they could work with the local community college to be able to provide these courses for inmates at a very low cost. That's the only reason why we were able to take those courses. So I had to take my own money, again, when I lost my father, and then I was able to pay for college courses through Louisiana State, Indiana University, Colorado State, all these different colleges. Thankfully, however, as of January of 2023, there is federal Pell Grant money now available for inmates, because as former President Donald Trump was leaving office, when he signed that massive stimulus package at the end of his term, buried in there was the reinstitution of federal Pell Grant money for inmates. And so that is a really good thing.
Yay.
I will say that came out of that administration.
Yeah, because that's so stupid to me that they wouldn't provide any funding for inmates, because how do you expect them not to come back in there if they don't have any?
I agree. I totally agree. There's a lot of people who feel differently, but I agree that if 95% of those who are incarcerated are going to be released at some point, the question becomes, how do you want them to be released? Do you want them to be released with transferable skills and knowledge and degrees and things that equip them to be productive members of society? Or do you want them to sit there and languish and learn how to become better criminals for 20 years and then come live next door to you?
Yes.
So I get my education. I'm starting to peel back the layers of my own addiction and kind of where things went wrong for me at age 14 and why I had such a strong need to belong and why I would forsake the principles that my parents instilled in me to do these things that would lead down a treacherous path of criminality and addiction and prison and all of that. And so it's all starting to make sense to me, right? And then I take that knowledge and I start to work with young people who are coming into the system who want a better life for themselves. And so I would mentor these young guys. I would work with them on their own education. They were working toward GEDs and things like that. And I would tutor them and talk to them about life and what they want to do beyond prison and things like that. And so in doing that, that also reaffirmed to me that counseling is exactly where I need to be, right? Because I enjoy helping people and using my knowledge and experience to show people a different way. And so with that, I then enrolled into a substance abuse treatment program within the prison. It was like a 7-month long program, and it's 5 days a week, very intensive therapy. And so I did that. And after I completed that, then I talked to the boss to see if I could work as an intern in the program so that I could get the clinical hours toward certification as a substance abuse counselor. Because even though I had a master's degree in psychology, I still needed the clinical hours to get certified. So even though there wasn't like a program already set up for that in the system, he said, you know what? He said, with everything that you've done to educate yourself and how much you've invested in yourself and your future, I want to see what we can do to make this a reality for you. So he talked to his boss and they cut a bunch of red tape. They allowed me to work as an intern, which means I was able to do assessments and orientations and one-on-ones, and I could do group therapy and lead the guys. And it really gave me all the tools that I needed to become a successful counselor. And so a couple of years later, I got state certified in Oregon as a recovery mentor first. And then the following year in 2019, I got certified as a substance abuse counselor in the state of Oregon. And then I released from prison a couple of years later in 2021.
So how was it like getting out of prison? Because I would imagine that so much had changed.
Everything had changed. Like when I went in and I wrote a newspaper article for the Oregonian before I got out, and I talked about how when I went in, it was all baggy clothes and stuff like that. Now it's like skinny jeans and just cars can park themselves now. And there's phones with cameras on them and video, like your video. And none of that existed when I was like, when I went in, the cell phone at the time was the little Nokia. You might not even remember. The little
Nokia. I had one of those.
Okay. Yes. And I think it has some little stupid game on there that you could play or something like that. It looked like Atari.
Like where you turn it to the side and the keyboard would come in.
Yes, it was not what they are today. So I knew that it was going to be a huge learning curve to be able to use a laptop and to use an iPhone and to explore the internet. And I just knew. And so I had never even had an email before I went to prison. I never even set up an email account. I didn't need them back then. You go in, you fill out a physical application, a paper application, and turn it in at the desk, right?
Yes. As much trouble as I have with like writing, I wish we still had those because they weren't those stupid keyword systems where if you didn't have the exact wording, because I don't make any money off of this currently. So I'm trying to look for a job till I can start to make money off of it. And off of this. And I've applied for hundreds and hundreds of jobs and nothing bid. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm gonna have to try to turn this into it, which is fine. This is what I've always wanted to do, but still. Right.
Yeah, no, it can certainly be tough. This world took some adjusting. Thankfully, I had the support of family and friends and my fiance. And so there's been a lot of support around me to help me get through this learning curve. But I feel like I've adjusted pretty well now. But I'll say it was very overwhelming at first. It was like there were so many technical things, like even going into the store for the first time. And I remember I'm expecting just to hand over cash and get my item. You use your card and then they Apple Pay, you put in your phone number and they need an email address if you want. What? Like, what is all of this? What is all of this? And so it just took a while to really adapt to that, frankly. And then like menus with the QR codes on them is, gosh, this is so technical. This is so technical, right? But I was able to, I remember I started looking for a job through LinkedIn. And so the good thing is before I got out of prison, when you get down to like your last 6 months, you start taking classes. So like you build a resume, like you learn how to build a resume. You do mock interviews. Because we always have to answer the question, well, you know, do you have a criminal history? And you learn how to answer that question and talk about that. And so thankfully, I got out with a pretty solid resume and I used that. I uploaded it on Indeed.com and to look for counseling jobs remotely. So a part of my sentence for the DUI manslaughter is that my license is revoked until 2029. So, which is 8 years beyond my release. I got out in 21. So for 8 years, I can't drive for any reason whatsoever.
Dang.
Yeah. I can't drive for any reason whatsoever. So
do you feel like that's harsh or no?
If I'm gonna be honest with you, I feel like it's a little excessive. I feel like 17 and a half years for what happened was enough. But I say that on one hand, and other people will look at that and scoff and say, how can you say that? You took two human lives. How can you put a number on that? I get that. That's fair. But I also know that if I'm transitioning into society and I'm looking to, so for instance, I speak across the country. So it can be challenging sometimes to go to another state and have to take an Uber for an hour away that costs me $80. right?
Oh my gosh, yes.
To go speak somewhere. And so if I'm committed to doing this work, it should not be that I have to continue to overcome hurdles out here in society. If you want me to integrate and be successful and be productive and do this community-driven work, why would you put another barrier on me and say that I can't drive to go do this work?
Which I guess their thinking is, we need you to prove that you're not going to...
I get it.
But
I get it.
Years is a little expensive.
Right.
One or two, five at the most. But
right.
Like that.
And so it's 8 years for me. But the law then changed in 2012. So anybody who was sentenced in 2012 and beyond is now what they call a lifetime revocation, which means they have to wait 10 years to be able to apply to the judge, to appeal to the judge to see if they can get their license reinstated, right? So I feel fortunate that it's only 8 years for me, which is still a lot, but at least it's not 10 years with the possibility that I might be able to get my license again, because the judge doesn't have to grant it after 10 years. They can say, no, come back and see me in 3 years. Then we'll talk about it. At least when my 8 years is up, there's no judge that can say, you can't get it. I can get it based on the way the law was written back when I got sentenced. So at least there's that.
That's crazy. And I'm on Medicaid waivers for my disability. And the bureaucracy that you have to go through just to get anything, it's just, I realize there has to be some stuff, but dang, it's like they sit around and think of stuff to make it complicated.
Like, yeah. Well, laws are laws for a reason. People don't do the right things and it continues to happen, and the law feels like it has to get more harsh and more harsh as the deterrent.
Yeah, they have to close every little loophole for every person that might abuse it, and
right.
People like me that need it can barely get anything.
I know. You're right. It makes it difficult for people who need certain things. So now that I'm out, I work as a substance abuse counselor. I work remotely here in Pennsylvania through an organization that's actually based in Portland, where I grew up. And we do substance use treatment, mental health treatment. We actually take all the 988 suicide prevention calls that come in from Oregon. We take those calls and I get people connected with mental health resources in their communities, wherever they live. I get them connected with drug and alcohol resources, wherever they are. And I speak at DUI victim impact panels throughout the country. I speak at conferences. I speak at alcohol highway safety classes. I speak at high schools. I got a 5-college tour coming up in New York with the Save a Life tour next month. Really excited about that. So there's been a lot of opportunities to get my story out there and to talk about drinking and driving and substance use prevention. So I'm really grateful for that.
Anything else that you want to add before we get off?
I just want to encourage people that if you are struggling with substance use or mental health concerns, and you just need somebody to reach out to and listen to and have somebody listen to you in the moment and help you get through that, please, wherever you are, you can dial 988. We are here 24/7 around the clock. I have wonderful colleagues who want nothing more than to be with people in those spaces and to provide the support you need to get through that moment. And then more importantly, to get you connected in whatever community you live in to in-person support, whether it be one-on-one counseling, group counseling, online support, insurance-based support, free support, sliding scale support, whatever the case, we have you covered. Please reach out. We'd be more than happy to help.
Counseling saved my life, literally. I won't get too much into it, but it literally saved my life. So counseling is the best, though. Don't be ashamed to take advantage of counseling. Where can people follow you on social media?
I only have one social media account, which is Instagram. So it's at Martin L. Lockett. And then there's also my website, martinlockett.com. They can reach out that way as well.
Okay. And be sure to follow us, me at Devin Readers, and the podcast at Wheel With A Pod, pretty much everywhere on social media. I'm on Instagram, TikTok, and Thread. So you can follow me on there at Devin Readers, but you can follow the podcast everywhere else. Instagram, Threads, like any place you want. Follow it. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Hit the bell. And we will see you guys next episode. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to follow the show and our guests on social media and subscribe to the show on YouTube or in your favorite podcast app using the links in the show notes. If you're listening on the podcast app, please remember to rate and review us. See you next time.